Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time. As we continue our year-long journey looking at the best, worst, wackiest, and all things in between action movies of 1993. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and joining me, as always, is a man who needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. It's screenwriter, stand-up, academic, and wisecracking drug dealer. It's Mr. Craig Draheim.
I'm scared, Scott. I don't think I'm going to make it through this fucking podcast.
That's an interesting
I was going to go with Dennis Leary, but his is so ranty I couldn't capture
everything. Couldn't quite capture that. Plus, we have a special guest in the form of writer, director, producer, Mr. Mike Peterson.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Can hardly wait to talk more about Judgment Night
for this episode. This is the first time on the All 90s Action All the Time podcast. I know I've had you on before on my other podcast, New Horror Express, for the Guilty Pleasures and for interviews. But it was so much fun recording with you on those ones. I thought it'd be great to have you on one of these ones talking about action movies.
I'll try not to get too tangential.
Okay. I'm not going to hold you to that. I know what we're like. This is a tangential grouping. You can see this one going off the rails. But it's okay. Now, on to today's 1993 selection, which is the cult urban action thriller, Judgment Night.
Nobody is taking dates. It's a bunch of guys going to a boxing match. That's it. Why are you looking at me like that?
Because I know your friends. They have the hormones of high school kids.
I'll be home early, okay?
Promise.
What do you say, fight fans?
A night out on the town. A heavy traffic jam.
Say something, I'm not going to miss this fight.
And one wrong turn.
We've circled this block about 300 times.
Yeah, enough of this scenic route.
What the hell was that?
He's been shot.
They're coming after me.
You gotta get me out of here.
Back off.
We can't just sit here.
Come on.
They got guns, John.
You broke rule number one. Do not steal from me. Oh, boys, rule number two, no witnesses.
Come on! Come on! Oh, go, go, go!
Where the hell are we?
What are we gonna do?
What do you think of the neighborhood?
The cops are gonna be here any second.
The cops are not coming.
What's up, you punks crazy or something, man?
Chill out, man. We're just looking for some citizens.
Don't move. Don't whisper. Don't even breathe.
These guys don't give up.
Oh, Frank, is this your wife, huh?
I get a wife and a little girl, and I will get back to them tonight.
Let's show these punks what we got.
You better believe it.
You're just another victim. You're just another victim, kid.
Hey!
You're just another victim. You're just another victim, kid.
Emilio Estevez, Cuba Gooding Jr., Dennis Leary.
You know, Frank, after I kill you, I think I'm going to pay a little visit on that wife of yours.
Judgment Night.
You coming?
The film was directed by Steve Hopkins, who directed such other 90s action films as Predator 2, Blown Away, and one we've already covered on the podcast, The Ghost in the Darkness. It was written by, well, the screenplay, the credited screenplay. It's complicated. There's a lot of things that go on, but we'll talk about that more in the body of the podcast. But this credited screenplay goes to a guy called Lewis Kolick, whose most notable credits include Unlawful Entry, Ladder 49, and a couple, another John Travolta, early John Travolta to early 2000s John Travolta movie, Domestic Disturbance. It was released in the States on October 15th, 1993. Critically, it's currently sitting on perfectly respectable 6.6 out of 10 on IMDb, a much less respectable 35% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 20 reviews, 46 on Metacritic, based on 11 reviews, and it has a perfectly solid 3.1 on Letterboxd. Box office-wise, it made a mere $12 million off of a $21 million budget, making it the 97th biggest movie of 1993. So that's your background details on Judgment Night. So before we get into talking about the plot of the movie and everything about the movie, first of all, I know that this was let's talk about if we've seen the movie before, what your relationship with the movie is. I think of all of us, actually, Mike, you're the only one who's actually seen the movie before. So we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I did see it. I remember seeing it at the theater. And I remember mostly being excited that Everlast from House of Pain was in it. And it was, you know, I remembered it being underwhelming at the time. And rewatching it, I remembered those few, you know, very few moments where it's like, oh, there's Everlast doing, you know, kind of gangstery, Irish gangster stuff, I guess. Which was kind of exciting at the time and was exciting to remember how I felt about it when I originally watched it. But those moments are very few and far between.
How old would you have been like when you saw it back in 93?
93, boy. I would have been junior high or something like that. Junior high, I think somewhere in junior high. And it's still like, it was still exciting to hear the soundtrack though. That's what I can also say. The soundtrack was exciting when I was a kid and it was exciting again to hear it now, even though it's actually a little underwhelming in the way it's used in the movie, because it really is outside of the beginning. It's, you know, it's just kind of dropped in here and there, but they don't make any big set pieces with the music per se.
No, they don't. There's a couple of moments where they make better use of the soundtrack, but yeah, the soundtrack is not particularly well used. I think part of that is because, like, it sounds like from an interview that I read with Stephen Hopkins, the director, in Consequences of Sound, it sounds like he didn't really get he got the soundtrack to an extent, in that he realized it kind of fitted with the film, but I don't think it's his taste in music, and I'm not sure he quite knew what to do with it. Reading between the lines in the interview, that's what I kind of picked up.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it was like a ambitious soundtrack, and I think if it weren't for the soundtrack, I don't know if anyone would still be talking about this movie.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little further. Craig, I just wanted to get your take on things. I think this was a first time watch for you, is that right?
Yes, this was the first time watch, and then I was surprised. So when we first talked about it in the beginning of deciding it, I know you mentioned the soundtrack, and I don't think I really had any clue about the movie at all. But then like I knew the songs from the soundtrack, but yeah, it was kind of seeing the poster, I was like, oh, I know I was a fan of Emilio Estevez because of Mighty Ducks or all this stuff during that time. So I feel like I recognized the poster, or well, at least the cover, but that was it going into it. And I was surprised because you talked so much about the soundtrack, of like Mike was saying as well, of going into this expecting it to really be front and center and not really hearing it at all.
Yeah, I don't think they kind of knew what they had on their hands before the movie was released, because like, yeah, you were saying you weren't really aware of it at all. I mean, as I'm a lifelong kind of metal fan, I've been into metal since my early teens. And, you know, the soundtrack is seen as like this kind of pivotal thing. Obviously, like rap rock had existed before. There was, you know, the famous Walk This Way, Aerosmith, Run DMC. And then even a couple of years before this, there was Bring the Noise, Public Enemy, Anthrax. Mm-hmm. But like, they're never, like, yeah, like an extensive album like this with rap artists and rock artists collaborating, it wasn't something that had really been done before. And it's kind of seen as like pivotal in the development of new metal as well, which is, I mean, some people would say that's a bad thing, but like
I would agree with that as a bad thing. I think that feels like an oversimplification of what it is, because most of these bands were kind of more the kind of like the beginning of grunge. And
yeah,
then like
that's true.
Skate metal stuff, not really like new metal stuff, like, you know, Teenage Fan Club and Mudhoney and Dinosaur Jr. And Pearl Jam, like that.
Yeah, no, I mean,
yeah, like that's.
I think the tracks that are kind of seen as like kind of indicator of where like metal was going, are specifically. Just Another Victim, The Helmet, House of Pain track, and Another Body Murdered, which is the Faith No More one, and I can't remember who they collaborate with. So there's a couple ones, but you're right. There is. It's more. I've listened to the soundtrack before quite a bit. Like, I remember the first time I was introduced to it was maybe about 20 years ago. Where there was like a Metal Hammer article about the soundtrack, which is the first time I heard of this movie. And the reason I never got around to watching the movie is because in that article and in subsequent articles, like, they always said that the movie's not that great, but like the, you know, the album's great. And yeah, and like kind of going back and like listening to the album in the last few weeks, yeah, it was less metal heavy than I remembered. Because it is really, you know, like a couple of tracks like that. And there's one with one that's got like Biohazard in it. And there's one that like Ice-T and Slayer like do a collaboration. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it is mainly from the grunge scene. And then like, yeah, you've got on top of that, like from the Scottish indie scene, Teenage Fan Club. And right. From the kind of New York kind of noise rock scene, Sonic Youth. So, like, yeah, it's much more geared towards that, and much less metal than I might have thought it was, or like I slightly misremembered how metal the soundtrack was. But even though, like I said, there's still there's like four. Metal kind of tracks but
even the I mean, we'll get into it obviously, but even the tone of the movie doesn't fit with the music at many points, where like the way it's shot, especially when you talk about things like new metal or grunge or movies that had a lot of those, you know, that type of soundtrack, they had kind of a very distinctive filmmaking style to it. Or there was that grit and this, I don't know how to explain it. I just watching this movie, it's just there.
It feels more like an excuse to do the soundtrack than it's like a natural outreach of the soundtrack, the themes and the movie and stuff. Like, they're not connected, and the only song they seem to really know what to do with is the De La Soul song Fallen, Teenage Fan Club. Only song that is very different than every other song on this, because it's really more of a cool kind of pop hip hop song.
Yeah. I guess like, because it's the most kind of chill, laid back track on the album. And I think they kind of knew what to do with that. I think the only other good needle drop is when they first get out of the traffic jam and they go they enter into the bad neighborhood, and like when he's like doing that driving maneuver The track there is Freak Mama, the Mudhoney Sir Mix-a-Lot collaboration, which is not a sentence you get to say a lot. and I think that's quite good, but like, yeah, other than that, it's just like little snippets of it, and it's poorly used other than Fallen, and I think like the Freak Mama drops like quite good as well. Don't know what you thought about that.
I'd agree with you there. The other ones you could probably, you know, drop 20 different songs and they would do the same thing for pretty much every other Beatle drop. They're not very distinctive.
Yeah. I think, like you say, I think it was an excuse. I'm glad that the music supervisor on the movie, on the soundtrack, Happy Walters, just decided to go off and do his own thing. Like you say, it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily fit, and they clearly didn't quite know what to do with it, but it did give us this album. And like you say, it's kind of the album in large part is why this movie is still talked about, because like this movie was a box office bomb, but the soundtrack, which very rare for a film, the soundtrack has its own separate Wikipedia page and went gold in America. That's just its US sales, you know, like it was, so it was a really big hit.
Yeah. And I still listen to it when I hear these songs. I'm pretty happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been like re-listening to it last few weeks, and it's a really solid album. And I guess we could probably make the whole episode about the album, but we will talk about the movie.
So how does it open, Scott?
How does it open? Yeah, right. So it opens in. But I think we kind of know what we're going to get in this movie, right? So this is very much a kind of survive the night, yuppies in peril type movie. It's in the 1970s, the middle classes were scared of rednecks, and now they're scared of the inner cities. That's what we're with this. They were in the 90s, and now we're scared of the inner cities. That's the middle class paranoia of the day. We get other middle-class paranoias of the day sprinkled throughout. We get some road rage in a bit, which we'll talk about further as well. But like, this is a weird thing. So this movie exists in a kind of weird place where, you know, the more I think about this movie, it's like it doesn't quite know how far to heighten the reality. So when we get into like the quote unquote bad neighborhood, it exists somewhere between like something like The Warriors, so like real comic booky, and like something like that's trying to be gritty. That's not necessarily a portrayal of reality, but it's trying to be gritty, like a Training Day. Let's say that. And it exists somewhere in between, very awkwardly. But the movie starts in almost ridiculously idyllic certain Spielbergian suburbia is what I would describe it. And it's all very sun-dappled, and it's all looks lovely. And we know that they're going to be shaken out of this idyll that they live in just in a little bit. So I was quite amused by that. And it's all like in kind of slow-mo. It really hits home just how perfect American suburbia is, despite what David Lynch movies tell us.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the opening on this movie because I quite like the shot, that slow-mo shot.
Yeah, it's
the nice speed shot. Ramps up once they get in there. Like, it's a nice shot. You know, there's maybe a little bit more kids bike riding than I think you need to do what they're doing, but I think it's the wrong opening for this movie. It's a nice opening as a piece of film, but I think it's the wrong opening for this movie because it's kind of setting up this like idyllic world of suburban life that these people are coming from. But really, it's only the one person, Emilio Estevez's character, who's coming from this world. The other characters have no backstory, and they seem like outsiders. They're not part of this sort of, you know, have a wife and a kid sort of trappings that the golden trappings that Emilio Estevez has. The other guys are sort of coming from nowhere. They're not coming from that world because they're entering that world. And when they enter it, they're actually also outsiders. I don't think it's actually functioning the way it needs to or should, even though it's a pretty shot. And I think it's a big problem because you're going into the movie with this as the way the doors open to the story. And I think it becomes kind of a letdown because it doesn't support it for the rest of the film thematically with what it's talking about.
I mean, I agree with that because I was going to say, so when the, having not seen it and not really knowing much about it, when the opening happened, there was that split second in my head of like second guessing of if this was the correct movie, even though I knew. But then, yeah, it goes really much, and I know we talked about this prior to recording, this whole dilemma that ultimately Emilio Estevez is having, where he's been, essentially it's been saying that he's been with he's had a newborn baby, he's been with it for 3 months, so as his wife, and he just needs a night out, and she talks about him needing to grow up, get away from these friends, have grown-up friends, stuff like that. But yeah, the whole thing just kind of feels off because he's not even really a part of, doesn't feel like he's even a part of their world anymore, where you get to really see that growth of him becoming the person that his wife wants him to, or is saying he's supposed to be, because he's kind of already there, and it's just all these different things. And then there's the brother played by Stephen Dorff, who or it's his wife's brother, kind of comes in, and that's even strange too, even though that's a relation to them, but he's an outsider as well.
His actual
brother. That's why I can't tell. Yeah, if it's his. Yeah, or...
I think it is actually supposed to be his little brother. Yeah, like it is kind of weird, like you say, but it's very, for the Emilio Estevez character, it's very static. It doesn't really grow that much. Like, so you think that the way the opening is, the way the opening dialogue with Emilio Estevez character, Frank's wife, who has really no character at all. We just see her for like 2 seconds, they have one conversation and that's it. But like when she's talking about growing up and growing up friends, you know, you think that he's going to go on some sort of kind of character arc. Not even like a kind of stereotypical action character arc, you know, like more of what I would call the Seth Rogen character arc, you know, where it's like he starts as like kind of layabout and then kind of grows up a little bit by the end of the movie. You know, he smokes slightly less weed or whatever. You know, like I thought like, yeah, but there's nothing like that. He's always the most grown up member of the group. He doesn't fit in that group. It feels like as soon as they're in the van, you know, the kind of RV or whatever, it feels like he has already outgrown these friends. Like these are just guys he knew from school or college or whatever. And yeah, he just still hangs out with them because he always has. And so he doesn't even feel a place with the group. So if they made them more kind of like, he's, you know, he puts on a front of being grown up when talking to his wife, but then he gets into the RV and he lets his hair down and he's like part of the group. I think that would make a bit more sense, and then like he could actually go on like a kind of character arc, where he's always the leader, he's always the most grown up, he's always the most level headed, then he's still that at the end.
Well, and then there's this whole conversation. So Mike, throughout, played by Cuba Gooding Jr., constantly references
Mike Peterson.
Yes. He constantly references about Emilio Estevez's character of Frank or Francis. You know, he used to be the toughest one. He used to have, you know, the biggest balls or whatever, all this stuff. But then even by the end, you don't see that, I feel like. It's like the build up to him being seen as this like tough, brawling guy doesn't really equal out to the, yeah, the, I guess, the legend or whatever of the
execution. Well, no, it's his brother. His brother gets those moments in the story, but he doesn't really. But that's kind of an interesting thing in this entire movie, because there's all this implied backstory. So it's like, oh, you're, you know, like the, he's like, because there's a different friend was supposed to go on the trip. And it's like, oh, you know, so-and-so can't come, but I invited someone else. And like, who? And then, you know, the brother shows up, and we know it's the brother because they say that like five times. To establish that relationship in some kind of weird shorthand, that, you know, his brother's troubled in some way, or they don't like hanging out with him, or he's a tag along or something like that. And his brother shows up and he's driving like kind of, you know, a crappy old sports car, and kind of squeals in. So there's all this implied weird backstory, but nothing's ever actually specifically talked about. So they never have to deal with any of the stuff from their past in any real way, because we don't know what their past is, other than there is some sort of past that they hung out at some point and they're old friends, and that they've got, he's got a brother that, you know, they aren't happy that is coming along with them. And he seems troubled in some way, but we don't really know how. And they kind of show him as, I don't know, what would you describe Stephen Dorff's character as? Like, he looks like he's maybe, you know, someone a couple years younger that hasn't found his way yet and is scraping by doing whatever he might be doing. But nothing else is said specifically.
Yeah, I couldn't tell his age. I couldn't tell if they're trying to make him out to be like a you know, a punk kid, as they would have called it, or if he was only a few years younger than them. Because
I think he was kind of more of a kid, because like Stephen Dorff was only like, I think Stephen Dorff was only like 19 or something when this movie was made. So he is a bit younger.
But why don't they want to hang out with him? Because he's like 19? What do they care? Like, you know, what's the...
I'm not sure. Like, Jeremy Piven's character, Ron, makes this kind of comment before he gets into the RV, when the, like, clapped out sports car rolls up, that, you know, it's like, oh, you know what, how it turns out, you know, every time we're hanging with your brother. Like, and it kind of makes this kind of implied comment that, like, him and Frank, Emilio Estevez, his character, it always get into like fights. That's kind of the implied kind of thing there. But like, Emilio Estevez, like, there's no real tension to that relationship in the way that it's kind of talked about. There's like a kind of talked about tension, but like Stephen Dorff's character is always kind of semi-rebelling against Frank, but Frank is nothing else, you know, than just like a kind of protective kind of trying to be some sort of kind of father figure. Like, he's never, they've never like butt heads really that much, apart from like that kind of one thing where he kind of shouts at him in the traffic jam, you know, like, and then kind of a couple other things, but like, there's no kind of like real kind of like, oh man, you know, there's obviously something in the past really between them. Like, it's never really played like that.
But, and that's why I'd say I got confused, because I think some of the more implied element was of deciding, well, is it his brother or is it his wife's? There was the confusion, because he does mention the thing of like, my wife says I should, it's like very quickly said about, like, my wife says I should hang out with him more. Are some sort of, it's like a quick, another, like Mike was saying, it's like all of these little offhanded comments that are supposed to build backstory but don't follow through with it.
Yeah, and that happens with Cuba Gooding Jr. as well, Mike Peterson, and it, like, they talk about all this stuff that happened in the past, like, there, we should know, and it seems like it's kind of important, but then we never find out what anything is.
And I think that kind of comes to like part of the frustration of the film, of like, yeah, nothing, none of these kind of little implied comments ever pay off. We don't really have like a big blowout. There's no like scene where the brothers start brawling. There's no scene where like Emilio Estevez's, you know, character Frank, like really unleashes this supposed wild streak he had back in the day. Like even towards the end of the movie, like it's quite calculated what he's doing. It's not like he doesn't like freak out. He doesn't like go psycho at any point. You know, he still seems quite in control, you know, like, which cuts against what we've been told about this character or this character's past.
But it seems like the character of Mike starts taking on the parts that could have been taken, you know, could have been used by Frank, like where Mike starts getting, you know, not going, I don't know if it's going crazy or snapping or whatever, but there's kind of those elements. And I'm wondering, because I know, you know, it talks about that the original script was a lot darker, if or if even there were more friends or something, because something feels off, or that there is kind of a lower, not just, well, we will be spoiling it anyways, but there's a lower body count than you would expect, and they don't really go through the struggles that you would expect in general.
Well, there's a lot of stupid stuff these guys do.
That's true.
Makes you hard to sympathize.
Like, talking, just going back to the script for a second, yeah, I think, like, I mean, the script went through many rewrites. The original script was written by Kevin Jarre of Glory and Tombstone fame. And, yeah, obviously he had... Kevin Jarre seems to be quite unlucky in some ways. He's had many struggles with some of his scripts, and obviously he got kicked off the director role in Tombstone. So, like, he wasn't having a good time around this time. But yeah, and then once Kevin Jarre was taken off, then it went through a whole bunch of rewrites. Several people rewrote this, and at certain points it was a completely different story. In fact, like, John Carpenter did one of the rewrites, and apparently at one point, like, the bad guys were going to be bikers, and it was going to be set in, like, the kind of Californian desert outside LA, and so it went on a long, weird journey from its where it started. I don't know what the setting of Kevin Jarre's original script is. That was in Chicago, or how they got from, like, the Californian desert to Chicago, but, like, they did in the end.
That would make more sense going, because they're going to a, you know, a boxing match, and it would make more sense that you would have these characters from, for example, LA, taking the commute out to Las Vegas where those matches are at, traditionally. Like, so them being stuck in the desert. But then I wonder if, because for me, Chicago felt off, and that they were going to a special boxing match there.
Where in Chicago? Where are the big matches in Chicago?
That's what I'm sure there are big matches, but not one. Normally, I thought Las Vegas is kind of the, like, where the big matches are, or, you know, New York with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, you know, obviously, I'm not American, you know, so this is from an outsider view, but, like, as somebody who's, you know, followed boxing on and off since the 90s, I mean, Las Vegas does seem to be the main hub for boxing matches in the States. And if not that, yeah, you know, like you say, like, you know, somewhere like Madison Square Garden, you know, like in New York. I was a bit confused. I was like, oh, I don't know what arena in Chicago they'd be going to necessarily for this big fight. And Chicago is not one you often see for, like, kind of world title fights or whatever. So I don't know what level of fight they were going to see either. I'm not sure.
It would make sense if they're going to but then they wouldn't be driving so late at night if they were going to, like, a different type of sports game, like baseball or even hockey or basketball, even basketball, especially with, you know, because during the 90s in Chicago, you have the Bulls that were huge.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Like, that makes more sense.
And, like, I know that, like, baseball and American football tends to be during the day, but, like, basketball generally has night games, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So that would make that would make sense if we were going to Bulls game. I don't know if like that takes you through like Southside Chicago or whatever you got. I don't know. Like, I mean, again, I this movie probably doesn't care that much about geography. No. I mean, it doesn't.
It doesn't care about geography. I would say even in the way it's filmed, it doesn't care about geography. Like, he hits that guy, maybe. He doesn't really hit the guy, though, I don't think. Does he? He hits the guy with the RV.
He kind of runs out, and I think he kind of wings the guy. Like, obviously, the guy has been... So maybe we should back up a little. They're going to this boxing match. They get stuck in traffic. They pull out of the traffic. They pull off the highway. And then they go and try and take a scenic route to get them back on the highway and kind of shortcut the traffic. But then they end up in a bad neighborhood in Southside Chicago, even though that's not really explained. You know, you kind of have to read that in the plot notes or whatever. They're stuck there. And then he kind of, this guy who's already been shot, we found out slightly later, runs across the road. And I think he doesn't fully hit the guy, but I think he might just kind of knock the guy slightly. And then he goes over to the... But then, like, the geography of that is confusing because, like, where he hit him, but, like, he's, like, on the pavement, like, quite a few meters...
Quite far away.
...from where he hit him. So, obviously, he couldn't have hit him that hard because, obviously, he managed to... walk to the sidewalk and then fall. So yeah, maybe he didn't really hit him that much. I don't know. I mean, like, in the initial shot it does look like he hit him quite hard, but then when you think about it, he can't have because he's so far away from the cut from the RV thing. Again, maybe we're overthinking.
Well, and then even my brain, and I just stopped myself from overthinking it, where I was like, but if they're in Chicago now, Chicago's has some pretty good public transportation, so that at any point they could have just hopped on one of the trains,
which they're driving underneath. I know. It was the geography. Yeah. I think is thrown out the window from the beginning, and I don't think they care. Like, from even just the geography of characters to the geography of the space to the geography of the, you know, how events play into the story, it's all kind of none of it makes any much sense to me, including the geography of time.
Yeah.
Because, like, really, they don't actually have to fight. They just need to hide and wait it out, right?
Yeah.
Is really what they need to do. Wait for daylight. Daylight will, you know, reveal some sort of safety because the world will wake up and business will go on.
Yeah.
Which they imply and they show as we get to the end of the movie, too. But these guys are like, no, we have to fight or we have to do all these things. It's like, not really. Like, you know, you just kind of have to find a spot that's safe or probably go 5 miles that way and then you'll hit a different neighborhood.
Yeah. No, that was one of those for the whole time. Like, this is just an exercise and then them not being able to stay quiet. It's like, all you have to do at this moment is just be quiet. And not cough, not talk to each other, and you're fine. But then that it's just this continuing cycle throughout the movie. They run away, they hide somewhere. It's like the people walk by, and then somebody coughs, or they're all talking too loud to each other.
Or don't hide out in a train full of like 1930s hobos.
Yeah.
You know, because you know they're not trustworthy.
Yeah.
You don't even have to know. There's no arrangement that you're going to make where you know that they're trustworthy. Or you're like, hey, sure. Because they go into this, they're hiding and they go into the boxcar and there's like a group of like, you know, sardine eating hobos or whatever they are. And there's what, like eight of them. There's like a lot of them.
I think this is like part of my frustration of the movie, even though there's parts of it that are really fun.
Yeah.
Is. That, like, it's like that kind of tonal thing of like, on the one hand, it feels like the movie is trying to present like a kind of gritty kind of like, you know what, if you take a wrong turn, this could happen to you. But then on the other hand, It's got all these kind of cartoon characters in it of being like, oh, here's the evil hobo gang. Yeah. And you're like, what? That doesn't seem like you have like a weird attitude to like homeless people. It's like, yes, once you become homeless, you become subhuman. You're like, geez,
Phil. Chud levels. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's chud level homelessness. it was what I thought was funny, and this is kind of a thing that happens throughout, where they make decisions that you know are bad decisions, but they're not even like really well, like they're just poorly thought, like even in the moment, you know, they're under stress, they're making bad decisions, sure, that happens, but they're like, they're in the car, they need to be quiet, there's a gang looking for them, and they're trying to hide out in a boxcar with a group of homeless hobo people. And they're like, hey, we'll give you a bunch of money if you're quiet. And they're like, yeah, we want that money. We want, you know, the watch, and we want cash, and we want your rings. And then we'll be quiet. And rather than be like, okay, if we get out of here, we'll give this to you. But we're not giving this to you until these guys are gone, because they're banging on boxcars and stuff as they walk by. So, you know, we'll give it to you, but we're not giving it to you until we're out of here. And these guys are killers. They might kill you too, man. So you should shut up.
Yeah.
But they don't, like, they have terrible negotiating skills. And the one guy's like negotiated this RV that they're driving around in, which really doesn't do anything except probably let you shoot all your characters for that first 15 minutes in a way that's more interesting than if they were in a limo or a car. You know, like, it doesn't really have any meaning story-wise.
Yeah.
Anyway,
once they hit the individual, then yeah, they see him get, basically he's taken, he's executed, they witness it, and then they pretty much drive away. They get stuck in a tunnel and the car breaks down, and they burn down the car as a way to escape. And there's enough time that even with all this logistic stuff, they could have just kept running, and at no point would the people have been able to catch up.
Yeah, so, like, after they kill the guy and they explode the van, because, like, Emilio Estevez does some MacGyver shit, I did think that scene was quite funny as well, because, like, the bad guys are bad guys. I know it's, like, a slow-mo shot of them coming towards the van, but they're also just walking. There's like no urgency, you know, despite the fact that like Dennis Leary as Fallon has said, like, you know, we gotta have no witnesses. Like, they don't express a lot of urgency in that moment to like run over to the van and start shooting up the van or whatever. They just kind of like slowly mosey towards the van, which I thought was, it made me laugh.
He goes against, because so this too feels like it should have been a bigger gang or something. And I know, and quickly going back, I feel like, I know this is has been mentioned many times, either on this or Guilty Pleasure podcast, of like certain things happen because the script says so. Like with the homeless people, it's like it just happens so that they can get, so that the gang can end up with the wallet of Emilio Estevez. But yeah, this is one of those moments where, like, we'll quickly jumping ahead, it'll be a spoiler. He kills one of his own men, and there's only four men. There's four of the friends as well. So you're already at this point of, like, you're really, like, you're not being a good kind of villainous leader. Like, everybody keeps shooting themselves in the foot, basically.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Like, I kind of thought about that when that plot point comes up later on in the movie, of being like, even at the start of the film, there's like four of those guys, like Emilio Estevez and pals. And then there's like the gang members are like, there's like five of them, like including Fallon, who's played by Dennis Leary. And that's it. So it's like 5-on-4. And then at the stage that Fallon kills that guy, it's like 3-on-3 by that stage. So then it puts the odds in their favor, because then it makes it 3-on-2 once that guy's dead. You know?
Yeah. It's interesting that the Dennis Leary, who's actually pretty fun in this, but he's mostly just kind of like walking around in monologue kind of stuff. But, yeah. But I mean, that's what he did back then, especially, right? That was why he probably got the job. But, and being an Irish, vocal Irish American guy, so he could be the Irish gangster character. But he's like really hung up on rules. Like he's got the, whatever the three rules are that he mentions. And one is like, you know, no witnesses, I guess.
Yeah, that's the second rule. Yeah.
But it's like he's so hung up on them that like he literally will like, you know, throw everything else away. He's like a very like serious bureaucrat. Very hung up on these rules to the point of his own detriment.
Yeah.
And then he gets that information about where Emilio Estevez is and he doesn't even use it.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't need to do anything except be like, hey, I know where your family is, dude, and your house. I'm going to go there right now.
Talking about things that are there because the script says to him, I thought an interesting plot point was after Fallon finds the wallet. And he finds the wallet of Frank. And we as the audience know that Frank is the hero of the movie and he is the leader of the group. But Fallon doesn't know that, and yet he leaps to that conclusion based on no evidence whatsoever.
Because if you based it off of what Fallon sees in the movie until the end, or what is actually shown, you'd think Mike would be the leader because he's the most aggressive one and the one really fighting back.
Yeah, it for is, sure. He is the one who does the kind of the action-y stuff pre like the finale.
Yeah.
So again,
which also I would think a bad leader.
Yeah, but maybe it cuts to your thing, Mike, that he just obsesses about certain things. So like he found that wallet, he saw that guy, he didn't like his face, and it was just like then he made Frank his nemesis. So they've been like, oh, I gotta get this guy. This guy has wronged me, him and his friends, but particularly this guy.
Which I wouldn't have mind seeing play out over like a period of weeks rather than a night. Mm-hmm. You know, so he shows up at his house a few days later. He, you know, he shows up at his work. Like he just kind of threatens him over time and kind of makes his life even worse. To let him know that if he ever comes forth as a witness, you know, it'll get even worse than that. That would be fun.
That would, yeah.
Yeah, if it was like more like a kind of, and again, that would be very early 90s, that kind of obsession thriller, that kind of, you know, yeah. So, and he just kind of continues to try and ruin his life and have people turn against him and stuff like that.
He's like a terrible manager, though. Just so hung up on these rules that he's literally willing to let his loyal men die.
So I was gonna ask you both what you thought of Dennis Leary's performance as the villain Fallon, because the thing about Fallon and Dennis Leary's performance, I think it is both the strongest element of the movie and one of the weaker elements. And I say this because I think that when Dennis Leary is on screen, the movie's at its most fun and has the most energy about it. And he has all of the best lines of dialogue. However, if they are attempting to do a kind of gritty style action thriller, and we're presented as this guy as being like a kind of a slightly heightened but semi-realistic drug lord, then that's terrible. Because he's a good action movie villain, but as like a kind of drug lord character in a more kind of grounded crime thriller, then you know it's just like he's a cartoon character. For me it's kind of the absolute strongest and one of the weakest. Do you see what I'm saying?
I would agree with that. I think, I mean, he basically, especially when he's talking to Jeremy Piven's character, when they're both on the rooftop, goes into full, as Dennis Leary doing a Dennis Leary stand-up bit, which I know we talked about was something that he did that was like his big thing in movies at the time because that's what people wanted. But
I mean, like, this is the third Dennis Leary movie we've covered, all from 1993.
Yeah.
We've done Demolition Man, we've done Gunman, we've done this movie, and he's played Dennis Leary in all three of them.
Yes. No, but I'd agree with that. Like, when he's talking to, and this again, Jeremy Piven, I'm jumping ahead, offers him $100,000, then offers him $200,000, and he turns it down because Jeremy Piven's character represents privilege and all of that, and he doesn't like that, and so he allows him to go on to a rant about class, and they're like, oh, you're not even playing a character now. but yeah, the type of movie it was, it felt very off. The type of movie it was trying to be some of the time, I don't know.
Fallon's character is essentially like the evil twin of his character in Demolition Man. They have the exact same thoughts. It's just like, you know, in Demolition Man, he wants to do kind of positive things, or maybe once, if he got to power, he wouldn't want to do positive things in the end. But anyway, Mike, what was your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think you're right there. That's a good point. But I think it also speaks to, you know, what is this movie? And I don't know if the movie knows what it is, because it is kind of a couple of different things. So is it, you know, because it kind of plays around with horror a little bit, right? With kind of that suburban paranoid idea of, you know, the danger of downtown. I mean, that's a horror trope of some sort. It can also be a thriller trope. It can also be an action trope. And I think this movie's kind of a little bit dancing around all of those without necessarily deciding exactly what it is. But I guess if you're getting Dennis Leary, you're probably like, well, let's just get him to do Dennis Leary things at that point in time, whatever the movie is, because that's why, you know, people are going to come and see Dennis Leary if that's what they did back then. I mean, and like, even like, he's got a couple other lines in there that I had to double check to see. I'm like, is this script or is this Dennis Leary doing Dennis Leary bits? when he calls him by like what I'm assuming is like sort of the, you know, the emasculated name Francis rather than Frank. Frank's like a macho name and Francis is the soft version. He's like, Francis. And he starts calling him that, you know. I'm like, that feels very much like a Dennis Leary bit or a Dennis Leary type of humor in this, you know, day in that period of time, or where he would make fun of someone like the soft version of someone's name, you know.
Yeah,
but
for sure you're right. And I think like a lot of the dialogue, yeah, I wasn't quite sure about that either. Like there's like a lot of the monologues that you're like, oh, is this actually in the script? You know, like we've kind of talked about it before, where he drowns the guy, where he drowns one of his own men later on in the movie. And he goes on this rant about this guy he knew in jail, and he just yacked and yacked and yacked, and he's always yacking and he can't get her out. And it's like a 747, blah, blah, blah. And he, you know, and it's like, oh, was this in the script? Or is this just a bit? Like, because a lot of his dialogue feels like bits.
Well, and that part is even played kind of, it's like it's supposed to be humorous, because it's like, was he actually trying to drown his henchman? Because the other henchman ends up going, saying, oh, I think he's dead. Or was it just he was trying to prove a point of like messing with him for a bit or torturing him, and then took it too far? And that's kind of the feeling that it gives off. He's like, oh, he's dead. And then they, you know, have to go out, continue on to the mission.
I always find weird, right? Like the henchmen probably have their own secret inner lives where they spend time together outside of being around the boss and have some kind of relationship. And then, you know, your coworker is killed in front of you, but there's absolutely no reaction to it. It's just, you know, the boss being the boss. Is it kind of how the business is treated? But, you know, it's just like, I hate it when, because you would never want to work for someone that could randomly kill you at any point in time. I just don't, I don't see the upside in that job, you know?
Yeah.
And it always be crazy in movies when they have the boss who's like just willing to like throw all his all his helpers, so, you know, just toss them aside like that. Like, no one will want to work for you. Like, I did, and they're not like they're in positions of power and there's any benefit. Like, they're wearing, like, you know, kind of crummy clothes. They don't have cool cars. They're just kind of walking around the empty streets at night. Like, it's a shitty job. It looks like a shitty job to me. What? But what's the upside? Why are people sticking around?
And they don't even seem like they're the stronger gang, because they come when they're looking for them at that apartment complex. They come across the gang of, like, younger kids who they're almost more threatened by, because these kids there's more of them and could, you know, do way more harm. And there's kind of, like, he's just willing to give them or bribe them a little bit, where he says, you could take, I'm not saying you're going to take my money, but you could take my money or whatever.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah. Because, like, and it's funny because, like, that, I mean, that makes the scene with Ray more silly, you know, where Ray offers him like 100,000 or whatever, and then 200,000, because it's not like Dennis Leary's character's a drug lord. It's not like they're getting shipments from Colombia and, you know, they're making millions a year kind of drug lord. It's like they are a gang, like a kind of nickel and dime, probably own one corner of South Side Chicago kind of drug gang. That is, you know, like, yeah. So I think that offer would definitely be a lot more tempting than the present.
But why didn't he get the other kid gang and be like, hey guys, I'll pay you $10,000 if you track guys down.
Yeah, then you would have had more gang members chase.
Yeah, you want to make some money? I got a problem. Help me solve it. We're all in the same team of criminals, and we're not competing gangs.
Yeah.
There's so many too. Like, he's just a bad leader. He's a bad boss. Like, there's just no evidence to support why this guy is successful or why people follow him.
But they do mention, like, again, in terms of offhand backstory, like, they do mention that he's like a cool gang to hang out with, you know. That's mentioned at one point. I'm sure Peter Green, who is misused, like, I do feel like you mentioned, like, Everlast, who really doesn't say very much at all. His most memorable line is like, oh, I think that guy's gone.
That's right.
That's like his most memorable. That's his standout moment of dialogue. But I do feel like Peter Green, who is fun, you know, he is like a fun actor. You know, we've covered him before in the podcast as one of the henchmen in Under Siege 2. Obviously, he's most known as like Zed in Pulp Fiction or the villain in Mask or whatever. Mm-hmm. But even he's kind of like, he's not given a lot to do. He's just like very obnoxious to people and throws out a lot of homophobic slurs, and that's it.
Yeah, just a guy that hates gay people is in a gang, a henchman who hates gay people, basically. Yeah, what else does he do? None of those guys are particularly good at like fighting or shooting though either.
Yeah.
No, I thought like so later on in the movie when they have the big confrontation and where they're being chased in the sewer, I thought there was going to be, I didn't think that Peter Green was going to be knocked off that easily, because throughout the course of the movie, Peter Green's character, who is called Sykes, is kind of being presented as kind of the toughest character in the gang, like actually kind of even tougher than Fallon himself. He's supposed to be the real hard man, and he is killed in like 2 seconds.
Well, and then it makes it seem for a split second that because Sykes is dead, that now Fallon is going to go basically, you know, blood crazy or something, because Sykes was his whatever friend or whatever it may be. And they make it seem like that for a second, and then kind of no, they take that away. Of like, if that would have happened earlier, you know, what if Fallon was going to let them go or something, you know, whatever it may have been, take the deal with Jeremy Piven, if it was rearranged some, and then oh no, now the deal's off. He just is gonna kill them all. Or, I don't know. I guess we're rewriting a movie though.
Well, maybe a bit.
We often do that. Like, yeah. It was a common theme in the Guilty Pleasures podcast, and we've done it before here too.
But Jeremy Piven's character is an interesting one in this because we're not sad when he dies.
No, he seems
kind of happy, scumbag.
Yeah, at first he's like just the fun friend with all the money, and then somehow he has a complete flip where then he's pulling a gun on them to his own friends and all this stuff.
So it's an interesting choice to do that with that character on basically the good team versus the bad team.
Yeah.
And then have him killed first. So there's no sort of empathy or sympathy that we have for it. It actually kind of makes us like the bad guy better. Because we can relate to that in the world that we're watching, But going back to geography, like where I was talking about, they don't care about geography in this movie, like all the way through. The way that the sewer scene works, like where the people are in that sewer space, the way they establish it, like I don't think any of those people can be where they are, kind of, based on entrances and exits and where they, what we've seen in the beginning, the way someone can come behind someone and then there's another person behind them suddenly. Like, I don't think it actually, who cares, kind of, but it doesn't really, I don't think, work in the way they establish the geography. And the same thing happens in the empty market closer to the end of the movie with Everlast, where Everlast should be coming from sort of the far end of the screen, but he kind of comes from the back left of the screen in terms of where he enters, because there's a very specific sort of gun battle where people are stationed in positions. And then he pops up in a place where I think it's impossible for him to actually arrive. Yeah. I don't know. It drove me a little nuts through it.
I have to say that, like, that's the kind of thing that normally I don't care about in films. But for some reason, there was a couple of moments. And like you say, particularly in the sewer, I was like, when Peter Green was behind, like, Mike, Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character, I was like, that doesn't make sense. Like, how can he be?
And then suddenly someone's behind him.
And I was like, it seems like there's only one entrance into that part of the sewer, and that wasn't there. Like, he would have been coming. No, I got kind of stuck in my mind about that. I was like, not sure about this at all. And then Emilio Estevez is aware too, and I was just like, okay, I guess I'll roll with it.
Yeah, I mean, you don't always get hung up on this, and it often doesn't really work in movies anyways, but usually you're not thinking about it because it at least follows like kind of screen direction or
something. Yeah, I think, like, as much as there's moments in this movie that really are super tense, there's also kind of moments where the movie's it kind of cools down, and you have like these moments to like think about things in kind of greater detail than maybe something that's either like going really fast or something that's like really kind of got nerve shredding tension. And then you might think about those things after the movie or when you're talking about the movie and be like, oh yeah, all right, that doesn't make much sense, but not so much while you're watching it. But I think there was moments in this movie that it just gave those kind of little bit of spaces to kind of think about this stuff and get a greater detail.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to say. And actually, for anybody, for people listening, I guess part of the joke of I was going to make was, because we're jumping all around, obviously, but pretty much the whole plot is like they get to a spot, there's a little bit of tension, like, are they going to get shot? Are they get shot at a little bit? Then they run to another spot, hide, they get shot at, run to another. And that feels like the whole movie. There's not really, but because of that, you just have this up and down, instead of if it was just like kind of a complete adrenaline ride of something like the Warriors, which you mentioned before, or, other things, where if they're really having to fight their way out of this section of Chicago.
And even like, in terms of like other kind of more kind of horror-y kind of things, kind of survival kind of horror action. You know, I don't know where exactly you would place it, but like something like Deliverance, where it is, you're really on the edge of your seat the whole time. And I think, again, in a movie like that as well, there's more stakes because you kind of feel like they all could die. Whereas in this movie, you're like pretty sure that most of them will survive the night.
Yeah.
I don't know if that you also felt.
I knew that at least because of the brother relationship. Like, oh, it's at least going to be. I knew for sure Emilio Estevez and then like and Stephen Dorff. Like, and then Cuba Gooding Jr. was definitely the, well, something's going to happen to him, but it's a wild card if they're going to kill him or not. But going into it before he gets killed, I thought, like, if they're going to kill anybody, it's going to be Jeremy Piven. I don't know what, but because they set him up that way.
What was Mike Peterson / Cuba Gooding Jr.'s, like, job, or what was his world? Couldn't figure that out.
The only thing we know about Mike Peterson, the character in the movie, not obviously yourself, is that he is an ex-football player. And he seems to see this as like the height of his life, of like his college football days is very connected to that. And that's really all we know. That's really the only thing I could gather about that character and that character's inner world, is like he's very connected to those days. And he wants some kind of adrenaline, some action to kind of connect with the kind of when he felt like kind of king of the hill back in his college football days. Like that's what I gathered from that character's inner world. Other than that, haven't a clue.
But he still seems like he's kind of doing well for himself enough that.
Oh yeah, he must be doing.
He's just like living the bachelor lifestyle. And same with Jeremy Piven. So they phrase it in a way where. He has a lot, so apparently he has a lot of money, but then there's another point where he's talking about hiring a whole sales team, and they say, well, or for his whole crew, and they make a joke about him not having a crew of salesmen. And so he's either very wealthy, which is suggested, and especially by the end, or he's kind of this guy trying to become very wealthy and just more showboat, I don't know. They don't give an exact read on what type of person he actually is.
There was another thing that came up in the conversations with Cuba Gooding Jr. and Emilio Estevez those couple of times where he's like, yes, boss, no boss.
Yeah.
And I'm glad Emilio Estevez at some point was like, dude, stop that. Because I was also like, dude, stop that. Around the same time. So I'm like, why is he saying that to him? Like, what?
With that as well. Like, I was glad they kind of knocked that off, and that kind of was, they let that slide.
But what are they referencing? I mean, the actors are working with something. They've created some sort of idea in their head of what they're saying and where they're coming from. But I couldn't figure out. It's not in the movie, I don't think. But it implied something. Yeah. And I just couldn't figure out what it was. But it's kind of like the muddiness of sort of the race and class politics of the movie. All the way through, where they kind of construct things but don't really say what it is. And I found it very very, I found that to be actually the most uncomfortable part of the movie for him.
Yeah, well, I know that he, because yeah, it almost seems like at points him saying the yes boss, no boss is like him being patronizing to Frank, but then also it seems like almost a form of endearment, or like different ways he says it at different points in the movie. Yeah, I don't know what the intention fully is, because I think the first time he says it is when was it Frank, Emilio Estevez, finally puts his foot down, and because Mike Cuba Gooding Jr. wants to keep fighting them, like, why don't we just. And then he kind of starts to have that snap moment. And so, and yeah, I think that's kind of where it starts, if I remember.
And then it ends with an endearing one when he's injured and on a stretcher saying goodbye. You know, I'll see you later. We'll go to another event sometime in the future. Maybe not. It's like, yes, boss.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of heartwarming, or turns that on its ear. it's some sort of inside joke at that point, but we don't know what the joke is, but the context. So it's really just was kind of uncomfortable that they have this some kind of weird relationship where that's a thing that they say when they're, you know, trying to call someone out on something.
Yeah. But even the brother, you'd think, because with him, with Stephen Dorff by the end, like he has that moment where here he is supposed to be the tough guy, and then he gets the chance to take out Sykes, but he freezes. So there's kind of that moment. But then he doesn't really, I guess he helps save Mike. But it's kind of that. But then they don't really all connect again by the end as they're all getting dragged down the stretcher. It's not like Mike now views, I forget Stephen Dorff's name now, the character's name, views him
Johnny.
As no,
his name
yeah,
is Johnny.
Yes. Yeah. It's not like they view him as like an equal or not just the kind of deadbeat brother now. It's just kind of, no, I don't know. There's not really a good resolution with their relationship dynamic besides Emilio Estevez saying that he's going to watch the Bears game with his wife. He doesn't want to go watch it with Mike. And then Johnny saying he's not going to hang around with them anymore or something, like in a joking fashion.
Yeah, they both walk away on their body. I'm too young for this shit.
Yeah.
I did laugh at that line. I was like, oh, that's great. I think, yeah, part of the problem is that you're spending a lot of time with these characters and they're not fully fleshed out. They do all feel kind of like stock characters, of being like the brother dynamic's quite stock. Emilio's kind of stock family man. You know, yeah, like Mike's kind of stock, kind of tough guy. You know, Ray's kind of stock, kind of sleazy business guy. Like, and that's fine. You can, if you make an action movie that's like, I don't know, like a Con Air, you can have two-dimensional comic book characters because it exists in a two-dimensional comic book reality, and there's so much kind of things happening that you don't mind, so it glides by. But if you're spending a lot of time with characters and it's more confined, then the character deficiencies become more apparent. And so you need to have stronger characters that you can kind of hang on to. And the thing of these characters is there's nothing much to hang on to. They're just like a collection of tropes and that's it. And I don't know. Like,
but Conair's an example of that because, you know, even if you take something like, those are fun characters that you don't need to know much more of than, like, you know, that guy killed and ate his entire family or whatever the thing is about the person. And then you have some kind of, you know, external, you know, dress that reinforces that they're crazy in whatever way they're crazy or bad. But these guys don't have any of that. Like, I mean, basically we've got three, like a bunch of goons that wear all black and have some, you know, accoutrements that are Irish-ish, like, you know, clover rings. But they're really just wearing black. And then the group of Emilio Estevez and his gang are just wearing kind of like, you know, normal clothes, with the one exception being the old sports coat from the, I'm guessing, the football team. But it's not like, you know, like Emilio Estevez, you know, loves hot dogs and took jujitsu, is a black belt in jujitsu or something, right? Like, there's not even a couple of those kind of points to hang on characters. Like, they don't have any distinctive one or two note elements about them. We don't know anything about them. So yeah, it would be cool if they did something, even if they did something like that, then you could play on the kind of the more of the comic book version of this movie, which is definitely, you know, is there, with especially the way like the downtown is portrayed and their lives a little bit, and this world of gangs and inner city toughness and whatever is played. So it's, I don't know, man, it's like they don't even do any of that, like, you know, just Cuba Gooding love, you know, cowboy hats and you know, gambling or something. Like, they don't have anything that plays in at any point in time. Which is it's a drag kind of, because even if you just added a couple of those elements, at least you could play those into certain character moments, and it'd be enough to just add a little bit more depth.
Well, and those type of elements wouldn't even take up that much time. You could do that with, you know, a simple line or two, you know. But like
or a wardrobe thing, yeah, or flipping a coin all the time, or something, yeah. But none of them have any specific characteristics about them. They're all just kind of a bunch of people that apparently did things before we see them in the movie, but nothing specifically.
Yeah, there's no kind of like quirks to hang on to. Like, say, there's nothing there that, like, oh, that explains how this character's acting. That explains why this is happening. And yeah, the characters kind of flip-flop kind of between things. It's like Mike's thing. Like, Mike, at a certain point when they get to the sewers, is like, right, now we've got to make a stand, and he makes quite a rousing speech about it. And then he kind of flips out, and like, he goes all kind of wild-eyed, and you know, you're like, oh man, he's really gone off the chain. But then you're like, oh, but then he just kind of resets, like, kind of 10 minutes later, and it's like the mic of the rest of the movie. You're like, huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
These things keep happening. Although, I know we're quite far into the episode now, and I do feel like we've talked a lot about the kind of the deficiencies of the film in terms of the plot and the screenplay and character and the kind of lack of character depth and stuff like that. But this is still, despite all that, there is like a great movie kind of hidden in here, and there is some really good stuff to it. So let's talk about a little bit about kind of like some of our kind of favorite things in the movie. And I'll like kick it off with, like, even though it is comic booky, even though it is kind of ridiculous, like the way we film, like the kind of urban hillscape of Southside Chicago, in that kind of Warriors Escape from New York kind of style, is quite fun. I think it's an interesting look. And I think, like, a lot of the cinematography, a lot of the way, like, when I was reading the interview with Stephen Hopkins, he said the movie he showed the crew for what he was kind of trying to do with all these night shoots and stuff like that was Touch of Evil, because they're doing a lot of stuff in shadow. And a lot of the stuff that they do that way, where, you know, like that first time we see Fallon, and before he shoots that guy and he's completely in shadow, and then the first time we see Dennis Leary's face is when, you know, the gun goes off and it lights up his face. And there's a lot of stuff, there's a lot of play with shadow like that that I think is really cool, and it makes it look distinctive. And so I think that's one of the strongest elements. I was wondering what you guys thought of that, and like some other things that you were drawn to in this film.
I mean, for myself, I know I can't. I think, yeah, I mentioned it before we started recording, but there was, based on our season so far with American Yakuza and Gunmen, where there's kind of this common theme of, you can really see there is. Here's these movies that were kind of forgettable, but there is a great movie in there. It's not like it's just a bad movie or it's whatever, where if it was just had leaned a little bit in one direction or had an extra couple minutes, whatever it may be. But no, I think I would agree with that. The way it's shot, when the moment there are kind of tense moments, visually speaking, it's done in a way that is a lot of fun, that doesn't feel as outdated as some of the other stuff we've watched. And I I like a lot. I mean, wow, we've complained about aspects of character and stuff. I mean, I like the dynamic, and as much as I want to hit harder and stuff, I do have like this kind of, yeah, this journey type of the idea of the plot itself, and I these friends and almost having this, what, a few 5 years later or so, Jeremy Piven would do something like very bad. What is it? Very bad things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like if they added, I know this is another hypothetical, where if you took elements of that and put it, smashed it in with it, kind of, and just really, I don't know. I think there's a lot of elements there that are impressive, and it kept my entertainment, I would say, more than other stuff we watched, or more than, yeah, I was focused the whole time and not just returning to my phone or stuff like that. So
yeah. For me, it's got a lot of promise, but and it does have some fun moments, and as like a time capsule, it's certainly interesting to show kind of whatever the, you know, certain attitudes were about sort of suburban life and inner city life and, you know, class and some of the weird things that they say about capitalism. But it's just like every single element of the film is slightly undercooked. But visually, yeah, I mean, that's probably the strongest component of the film in a lot of ways. Like even when they introduced Dennis Leary's character, he's entirely in shadow for the whole thing, so we don't actually reveal him until, you know, later, a little bit later. So he's sort of this faceless bad guy who's in the shadow, and I like stuff like that. I mean, it was you can tell it was, they thought it through, and there was an approach and an idea for all of it, which was cool.
And I know one of the, when I was looking at reviews or stuff like that, one of the big reviews about it, we're saying kind of that element of like the execute, it was something that had an amazing execution but didn't have the art. I'm paraphrasing what the quote was, but so that's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, no, I agree with that in a sense that it's technically an excellent film in the way it's shot, and some of the scene composition, and, you know, because I mean, some of the shots are really cool, you know, as I discussed, the first introduction of Dennis Leary completely in shadow and having his face lit up by the gunshot of executing the guy, and there's like a really cool shot when he's like giving orders to the team in the sewer, and it's just like a kind of close up of his mouth, and then you yeah. see the guy in the background, and you know, it's really artfully done, and there's many shots like that throughout the movie, and I think that, yeah, if you just kind of take the film kind of shot by shot, like that, it's really well done, and there is some moments of real tension, when, you know, even though it does feel like kind of, you know, like a kind of rinse repeat kind of movie of like they're always doing the same thing, so it gets a bit boring after a while. And I think the running time being an hour and 50 minutes actually counts against it because of that, because of the structure of the movie and how it's always finding a place to hide, getting found, running to a new place. Like if you took like maybe 15 minutes off the movie, it might kind of tighten up a bit, and it might not seem kind of like, it might not drag by the end if it had just been slightly shorter. But there is some good tension in those scenes, and you know, when they are escaping between the two rooftops, like that's really nail biting. And there's a couple other kind of standout scenes like that that I think are really, really effective.
Well, and I, speaking of that shot with the in the sewer where it's close up of his mouth, it almost, that's kind of one of the issues, is that feels, it's, and I know, Mike, you talked about the opening shot where it feels out of place with the rest of the movie, where that shot too feels out of place in a way, like, oh, that's a cool kind of shot they're doing with him giving the instructions. That's just of his mouth, and you kind of see their little them on the side or whatever it may be. I wish they did. Why didn't they do more of that? Then, you know, it's a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this cool split diopter shot and all that. Yeah. I don't have too much more to say about this movie, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I revisited it, but it's like, it's really just about the soundtrack for me. And, I don't know. I just don't know if this movie's, like, out of all the other movies that were made like this, I don't know if this one is, you know, worth revisiting that much based on what this is. I don't know. Do you guys like the, everything's just undercooked, and there is some cool stuff, but it's just kind of missing it all the way through, with a few flourishes of kind of cool moments here and there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is, like, for me, I'm the same. I love the soundtrack. I've been listening to it a lot over the last couple of weeks, and I'm really enjoying it and revisiting that. I think the soundtrack is amazing. I don't think the film's amazing. I read about it 20 years ago, and the music articles I read about it often said the movie's not that great. And then I was like, over the last few years, I was like, oh, maybe I should give it a try, because I'd heard a number of action fans kind of bigging it up and saying it's like a kind of underrated, underseen kind of movie from the 90s. And I was like, well, maybe I need to give it a whirl. And I didn't not enjoy it. it was fine. It has its moments. It does have some fun moments, but it's just, if everything was just, I think if they fleshed out the characters a bit more, that would have made a big, big difference, because then you're kind of hooked into these characters' journey much more. If the characters had a bit more of a character arc, particularly the Frank character, because he is very much our lead, and we're very much told that right from the beginning. I think if it was slightly shorter, it would increase the tension. And for me personally, I mean, some people really dig this film, so obviously this is not a problem for some people. But for me personally, I think I would rather they tonally went one way or the other. So if they wanted to make it a fun, goofy action movie and really lean into the kind of Warriors style comic bookiness, I think I would have dug that more. I also think I would have dug it more if they really lent into making it like a mean, like street level kind of crime thriller action movie and given it that more grounded reality. But given it this kind of in-between being cartoony and gritty, just didn't quite sit for me. But I still generally was entertained. The performances are generally still good. Emilio Estevez is likable. Cuba Gooding Jr.'s performance is pretty good. He has some fun moments, even though, again, slightly undercooked, I think, restricted by the screenplay, which I think is the weakest element of the film. And Dennis Leary does Dennis Leary shit, and that's kind of fun to watch as well. So that's kind of like my overall feelings on the film. Craig, do you want to expand on that, or you know?
So no, I mean, I agree with both of you. I think it's one of those. Cuba Gooding Jr. I'm not sure if it's between him and Dennis Leary, of course, that I think he even steals the show at some points, but I know.
Yeah, at some points, I would agree with that, yeah.
Just incorporating more, just in general, or like either character development, if going towards a more gritty way of like a Death Wish, of a Deliverance, of whatever, or if you're going into the spectacle kind of trope, action-y, cartoony way, then lean way more and add more kind of spectacle, add more violence, but you know, it is forgivable in the sense that it's not the first of its kind and it's not the last. So it's like there's stuff that came out before it and monumental or even, you know, just more enjoyable, and there's stuff like afterwards that was better. So it's like in this weird, it just, you know, I'd rather, if I want to see a kind of constant adrenaline rush of having to fight a bunch of gang members, even a newer film, I'd watch The Raid, or I'd watch Warriors, you know, both before and after, or, you know, it's kind of all over the place like that. But yeah, I mean, I liked certain elements of it, and there was a lot where, again, as we've talked about watching it, where I was like, oh, it's just something right there that could have made this such a good movie, and I could see it. It's like I can almost reach it, but it just, it's just like an inch out of reach the whole time.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think you guys have hit the nail on the head. I have to go run out and pick up a child, so I'm gonna have to sign off here right away. But I just wanted to thank you for having me on here, and it was fun to talk about, and it was fun to revisit this movie because I had not seen it since I originally saw it. And the one other thing I did notice was it's a very short cast, and I couldn't help notice that when I was watching them all walking together. So while I was watching the movie, I had to check all the heights of the actors because I was like, I think they're all like 5'6", 5'7", because everyone feels very little. Anyways, not really a story thing or a other thing, but I guess when you watch these movies and you have room to notice these things, I don't know what that says, but it probably says that they haven't quite hit the nail on the head.
But, yeah, thanks for joining us, Mike. You can now go to your obligations, but thanks for coming on. Come on again whenever you want.
I always enjoy myself, and it's great to check out these movies that I haven't revisited before or haven't revisited in a long time. So always fun to talk about movies, whatever it is, and to dig into all that, because I think we learn stuff each time we do it. So thanks a lot, and we'll talk soon.
That is it. That's us covered Judgment Night. I'm sure a lot of people will have disagreed with us, and maybe some will have agreed with us. I know some people are real fans of this movie, so I'm sorry if you're a real fan. I know we kind of did it a little bit hard. We also noted that there was some fun elements. I don't think this is a terrible movie. I don't know like what you would rate it, Craig. I gave it 3 stars on my Letterboxd, which I think is...
I would give it 3, and I would actually say, to defend ourselves, that it is a compliment of us talking about it the way we are, because if it was just a bad movie, then like I don't think it would really be that much of a debate. It wouldn't be that much of a conversation, where I think much like a... No, there's something really good there that it just doesn't live up to its potential.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, which makes it like it's partly a fun watch, it's partly a very frustrating watch. I think we both landed in the same place on this movie, and I think you're right. I think it is a compliment to the movie and the potential of the movie, and some of the things it sets up, that we're being hard on it. Not because we hate the movie, but because we're rooting for the movie.
Yes.
We think that there's these bits that it sets up that have the potential to be excellent, to be a 90s action classic, but it just doesn't. It just fumbles the ball a little bit, for our taste anyway. Well, that is it for this episode. Thanks for joining us again. If you did like what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And also, please join us again next month when we will be talking about the Dolph Lundgren action film, Joshua Tree. Until then, though, see ya.